Time to move on to agenda item three now, dealing with contingent pricing of PP&E and intangible assets. And Fabienne has come to join us to update us on the project to date.
Good morning. Turning on to agenda item three, the committee received a request asking for guidance on how to account for contingent payments agreed for the separate purchases of property, plant and equipment or intangible assets. At its meeting in January 2011, the committee decided to take the issue onto its agenda. And the objective at this meeting is to obtain feedback from the committee on the accounting for subsequent changes to the liability that reflects the contingent price in the context of the of existing literature and the current discussions for the discussions for the current four projects on leases and revenue recognition. More specifically, at the committee meeting in March 2011, the staff was directed to present further analysis on how to account for subsequent changes to the liability and to consider whether there are circumstances in which the remeasurement of the liability for the contingent price should be included in the cost of the asset. We have reviewed the existing IFRS literature that provides guidance on the accounting for subsequent changes to an item of the statement of financial position, and we outline the paper of findings and or analysis on the drawbacks and advantages of IFRIC 1 in paragraph 13 to 18 and IFRS 3 in paragraph 19 to 30, and the recent decisions on the leases on revenue recognition projects that were reached at the main meeting, main more board meeting in April 2011, are reproduced in paragraphs 31 to 35 of the paper. All findings so far with respect to the existing IFRS literature. We note that there are circumstances in current IFRS literature under which changes to the financial liability are recognised as an adjustment to the cost of a related asset rather than recognised as profit or loss, own profit or loss. Similarly to the measurement period in IFRS 3, IAS 69/38 set a period during which the cost of the asset may be increased by directly attributable costs. Given those findings, we ask for your feedback as to whether you believe that the accounting for measurement period adjustments in IFRS 3 could be a sound basis for setting the accounting for some subsequent changes to a liability for a contingent price for the purchase of an asset. On the recent board's decisions, maybe a bit contrary to what's written in paragraph 32 of the paper, there seem to be still uncertainty as to the existence of the liability that reflects the contingent price on the date of purchase, irrespective of whether the buyer has controls or not the realization of the triggering event. The recognition of revenue from the seller side being based rather on a reasonable assurance that revenue will flow to the entity. As to the leases project, our understanding is that the accounting for subsequent changes to the variable lease payments will be discussed in the board meeting in May. So we may have to wait for that those decisions. So we recommend that the committee should take no action as for now and should wait until the board has concluded before going any further. So the first question for you is really on the measurement period adjustment in IFRS 3 as being a basis, not a full analogy, but not a basis for a full analogy, but a basis to try and develop a rationale to account for the changes in as an adjustment to the cost of the asset. So that's the first question for you.
Okay, comments on the first question? Laurence?
I disagree that IFRS 3 should be the standard to which to analogize for this situation. IFRS 3 is a standard for business combinations. Here we're trying to determine the cost of an asset. And this morning I was attending the an outreach session with the pharmaceutical industry, which I found very, very interesting and useful. And we also had the presence of some ISB staff on revenue projects and so on. First, I do believe that this question about whether a liability should be recognized at the same time that the entity gets control of the assets is a really real one that is not yet concluded, and I would disagree that IFRS 3 is the right analogy which would require the liability to be recognized immediately in each circumstances. I do believe that with the discussions that the board is having on the other projects, there is sufficient ground not to precipitate our conclusions on this. And I do believe that looking at this measurement period and just saying everything that takes place in the measurement period goes to the cost of the asset and everything that is beyond, I suppose, would go to P&L, although it's not really specified, is also not the right criteria. Because what does it mean, the measurement period for purchasing assets? Measurement period was something arbitrary for business combination where you set it up 1 year so to enable better determination of fair values. Here again, it's different. So I do not support this analogy with IFRS 3 and the measurement period. Besides some, and this morning was said at the outreach session, some elements, some contingencies take place, or you have some contingencies after asset is being used and it may still be some enlightening about the asset you have purchased, so linked to the intrinsic nature of the asset, and in which case I do believe that there is ground to say that those additional payments you make form part of the cost of the asset.
Okay, so you agree that it's a sound basis, but you would like some more discussion when we get to question two on what happens. Peggy?
Yeah, I would agree with Laurence that I do not agree to refer to IFRS 3 because it's different, buying an asset versus buying a business. And I think the EITF also had looked at this in 2009. It's 09-02 on research and development costs, where they said to look to the guidance on contingencies, FAS 5, or on derivatives and hedging, FAS 133, as to what to do here.
Okay. Joanna?
I guess I slightly interpreted your question in a different way, in that to me I read it as, are you happy that IFRS 3, if you like, takes it away from IAS 39 and therefore we could use that as a basis to develop something, in which case I absolutely agree and that I think that the cost bit's got to come first. So if you do it in order, it's what is the cost? And then I would say, well, 3 allows us to diverge from 39, so how can I now build that in? You know, that there is a principle there. Can I do that for these other things as well? Obviously, though, and I agree with your question 3, depending on what comes out of these projects over the next little while.
Okay. Andrew?
Well, we did encourage the staff to look for the silver bullet solution, and so we ought to thank them for that. But I do struggle with the measurement period analogy, because the measurement period is really all about getting to the number you would have got on day one if you'd had all the information available. And I'm not, and you, as the paper acknowledges, once you've done that, you actually restate the number you first had. I think what we're talking about here is something different. So I do struggle with that. And I know we're desperately trying to find a hook on which to avoid subsequent remeasurement through the P&L, but I don't think we've found it yet. And I think it does come, at the moment anyway, it does come back to some fairly fundamental issues as what do we mean by cost? Is cost day one fair value, or is cost all the cash you ultimately spend in respect of the item? So whilst I appreciate the staff's efforts, I don't buy the measurement period analogy.
I think there are probably two aspects, though, of what the staff's recommending. By looking at IFRS 3, then, as Laurent said, that requires some estimate of the liability at that date, and then a period of true-up which follows, which is really looking at the measurement period. So there are the two aspects in there. And whilst it may not be your silver bullet entirely that you're looking for, are you quite happy to recognize a liability on day one? That is, to put some value to the contingency.
Happy? I'm not sure I'd use that word, but...
whichever word you'd like, Andrew.
I find it difficult to avoid that at the moment.
But it's difficult to avoid because of IAS 39, or...?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the other part, then, of what the staff is asking you, that if we could close off IAS 39 and say IAS 39 does not govern the recognition of this obligation, would you recognize a liability, or would you prefer not to recognize anything, and then we'll deal with the true-up later? I think whether that's it goes right to profit and loss, or whether it goes to the cost of the asset is a subsequent question. But the day one question is...
Well, I would prefer that the last solution, take it as it comes, but I'm interested, I'm not sure I could comment, but I'm interested in your supposition that we can get rid of IAS 39 in that particular equation. Maybe we can.
At this phase of the project, we can dream
we can
up
anything.
Anything. But we need Wego and Philippe and possibly even Tuck at some stage to vote in favour of doing that, and they might not like to do that. But we shouldn't. I don't think we should put it off the table, but that's... Scott?
I prefer, after reading all of this, that we try to come up with something that says once the asset is ready for its intended use, we're not going to change its cost anymore unless we actually add to it, enhance it, or what have you, which paying off a contingent purchase price doesn't do. So I would have looked at a solution that gives the final measurement of the cost at the time the asset is ready for its intended use. So in that context, I would want to book something at that point for contingent purchase price that hasn't yet been paid. I don't know if I care whether I book it before that or not, but by that point, I want to book the liability. We could question whether we should book it at best estimate or probability-weighted estimate or fair value. In that regard, I think I'd prefer to look at measurement characteristics that are already used for similar liabilities. So look to IFRS 3 or IAS 39, which both would record it at fair value. But to me, changes in whatever basis I record, changes in that happen after the asset is ready for its intended use, feel like they wind up going to P&L to me. And that's one of the reasons I want to book a liability at the date the asset's ready for its intended use, because I do feel like the literature tells me to stop booking costs as part of the asset balance at that date. So I'm not sure if that means that I like the analogy to IFRS 3 necessarily, but it's reasonably close to that. But if we do something like that, I wouldn't call it a measurement period. I would just say the liability that exists at the date the asset is ready for its intended use, the offset to booking that liability all goes to cost. Any changes in that liability after that date go to P&L. That being said, though, the lease project leaves me wondering whether the measurement of that liability is zero. So,
but from what I heard you say earlier, you're somewhat agnostic as to whether the liability is booked on the date you get control of the asset, but you do want the liability booking on the date it's ready for its intended use.
Yes, because I think we have to be done recording costs at that date.
Ruth?
I also understood the staff's question about IFRS 3 not as Laurent said, but as whether we could make some analogy to the measurement period adjustment. I think there's enough guidance in IAS 16 to allow the asset to be booked at the estimate at date of acquisition, because IAS 16 talks about the cost being the cash or fair value. So I think you can include an estimate, and IAS 16 lets you do that. Then I think what the staff have tried to do is that, is there a time period in which you can adjust that estimate against the asset rather than to P&L? And you've tried to find an analogy through the measurement period, which I'm not sure works, because IFRS 3 is talking about what would the cost have been had I known that information, whereas in contingent consideration we're usually talking about future events, extra amounts that I'll have to pay should I make future sales, I'll have to pay more. So you're actually not looking back, you're looking forward. So although I appreciated what the staff tried to do, I don't think it's the solution. But I do think we have a solution that allows us to include an estimate of the contingent consideration in the cost at the acquisition date. We don't need IFRS 3 for that. We've got it in IAS 16. And then I actually can't see any other way than to remeasure through P&L, the liability through P&L, unless the board decides differently with leases.
Okay. Jean?
I think there is an issue currently with the recording of the liability at the acquisition date. I think it's there's different practice out there, and maybe IS 16 is sufficient, but I think one way to really clarify would be to analogize to IFRS 3 or whatever the use of IFRS 3 we want to make to really assert that at the date of acquisition, the liability should be recorded at fair value. I think it would stop some diversity in practice in this respect, and I think it's the right answer personally. But the lease project is really bring diversity in practice if you want to, or will move away from a fair value measurement. I think business acquisition or asset acquisition at the outset, you should do a fair value of the liability and record that. With respect to future changes, I don't agree to refer to IFRS 3. I think the measurement period adjustment is specific to business acquisition, and it's been designed for lack of clarity into the view or a lack of view in the assets, net assets of the acquiree. I think cost is the cost at the date of acquisition, and should stop there, and subsequent changes, I think, should go to P&L. The issue, though, is when you have a self-constructed asset and then you've got this date of acquisition that moved forward. I think you could argue that the date of acquisition ends, and therefore cost adjustment ends when the assets are ready for their intended use, and we could say that. So the analogy for IFRS 3 for measurement period adjustment, I think, is not the right way to go.
Jean-Louis?
It's the same type of reservation. I think that the paper as written is a factual presentation, but it's not really making progress toward a solution right now. I think we are not making in the paper a clear reference to the draft standard on leases, and there is a solution which is taken, which is different. And I think if we want to have a full picture of what is done now or what is in the process, we should make reference to the lease project, because the solution is different. And I think that the making an analogy purely to IFRS 3 is not sufficient. It increases the idea or the obligation to book a liability, but I think that the mere application of IS 16 take you to the same position for good reliability. The point is, till what time? And the second point is, what if there is a variation between the reliability till the end of the acquisition period and the period of use, what are you going to do with this variation? And I think if you apply IFRS 3 by analogy, you come to the to a quite mechanical solution that effect is on P&L, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure because we must go in more detail in the problem, and because if we make analogy to other standard like early leases, you might come to a different solution. So it's too early.
It's almost similar point. If the intention of your question one is just using analogy of IFRS 3 to the single asset purchase, I do not support. But if the intention of your question is that we've got to do something with this issue, then I will support. The point is, now we have IS 32 and IS 39, could be IFRS 9. But this is the standard for financial instruments, and especially about the liability side. If the liability itself is a standalone liability, then it's all right. But in case of single asset purchase, then it's not really a standalone liability. So therefore, I don't know whether simple application of subsequent measurement, measurement of subsequent changes recognized in profit or loss is proper accounting solution. And in the IFRS 3, similar issue is discussed. Now the solution of IFRS 3, in my interpretation, up until the measurement period, it is the just the measurement inside of the business acquired. So in the inside of the business acquired, you should count on the what is the proper cost of the assets. But after the measurement period finished, then it goes to the financial instrument transaction. Then once you call it the business, and you finish the business transaction, then it's a second stage. That is my understanding. That's why we have to use the IS 32, 39, and IFRS 9. But in case of a single asset purchased, this is the business of the entities on its own. So then there is a close link between liability and asset side. And some assets may increase the value. It could be self-generated value, but actually, because there is a value increase, that's why the liability increase. So it depends on the nature of the assets, but it is different from straightforward, just liability, standalone liability. So if we simply apply IFRS IS 32 and IS 39 and IFRS 9, it causes some problem. That is the point. And then we've got to do something. And if the intention is of your question is in my same as my interpretation, then I will support.
Guido?
On the liability side, I understand that the staff is looking for the solutions, especially from the leasing project. Would be interesting to see whether in the leasing project, and that's also laid down by 39 of staff paper 3, irrespective of whether the buyer has control or not over the realization of the triggering event, you would recognize a liability that would, from my point of view, contradict what we have in IS 32. Now then the question is, would we relate to the new leasing standard or would we look into 32? So that's for the recognition of the liability, whether it's upfront or later on. On the other side, I have some sympathy for this measurement period approach in the sense that is described in paragraph 23 of the staff paper, where they say, well, if it's not restricted to a certain period of time, like 1 year, but you may look at this period as something, if you get new information about the quality, the character of the asset that was sold at the transaction date, and you have to pay something for that new information, then that's fine, that's part of the cost or the acquisition cost. So I can see that that might be a starting point to develop some interpretation. I would not agree with what has been said before that you would only capitalize costs up until the asset is ready for its intended use. There is something in BC 14 and 15 of IS 16 where the board realizes or says that costs incurred by using the asset might also be acquisition costs if they are similar to what acquisition costs normally are. And we have another example in IFRS 3. The measurement period issue is also something where you would say, well, it's in the business obviously is ready for its intended use, but you would recognize changes in the liability in this measurement period and then would probably add it to the acquisition cost of goodwill. So I don't think that the intended use threshold should be the reason for stopping capitalizing cost. So I guess that's what I would like to say.
I agree with the staff that we should wait for other standards to get finalized before we take any move, but not just IFRS 3, because both revenue recognition and the leases may have more developments which may have impact on effects on this paper. For example, in paragraph 32 in this paper, assume that the royalty may be recognized as sale upon signing. That's not how farmer industries do this, and they not plan to do so. You know, there are some discussions to encourage board to consider some development milestones for subsequent payment may be included in the cost of the asset. So when the payment is later triggered, to put those back in the cost, accounting for royalty is really a recognition and not a measurement issue. So we should wait on the final sale and revenue recognition in the leases.
Right. Peggy, did you want to make a point?
Well, I meant to say before that I do agree with waiting until the board finishes their deliberations, but also the discussion here, it's more theoretical, and I think if we put an example in of an acquired PP&E that has contingent consideration and a measurement period adjustment that would impact that, I think that just might help to just frame the discussion a little bit, because I think it affects certain industries more than others, like the pharmaceutical business and the like.
Yeah. Okay. There isn't a clear yes to your question, Fabienne, as I'm sure you suspected. And in some part, that's because people are still waiting to see what happens in other board projects and whether that would color the view. I get a sense from many people, though, that current literature would require the recognition of a liability on the acquisition date. Not everybody necessarily would prefer that, but that's where we are at the moment. And that's why there's a lot of concern over the leasing project, because if that clearly says in similar circumstances, if you're acquiring a leased asset, that you wouldn't recognize a liability, then we would appear to have some contradiction in the presentation. So for that, we have to wait until the board has actually concluded on what it will do on those assets. We can circle back to it. But many have commented on, in fact, the second part of the question, which is whether you can continue to adjust the cost of the asset, and up to what date? Is it right up until you've made the final payment, or is it something sooner than that? Some suggestions for when the asset's ready for its intended use, and perhaps the other extreme is no, you don't make any adjustment. And that's without considering where any adjustment to the liability that doesn't go to the cost of the asset should be reflected. So I think that's really embodied in your question too, isn't it? That if the supposition is that if we have or have not recognized a liability for the contingency at the date on which you acquire the asset, but that there are some subsequent payments that are triggered by whatever the contingency is, what types of event or what is the nature of those transactions that should, in your view, enable the entity to recognize that change in the value of the liability or the total liability as part of the cost of the asset? Ruth?
Well, I guess the question I have is, even if we wait for leases and revenue, will we get an answer to that specific question? And then what are we intending to do with this? Are we going to do an interpretation, or I'm not clear where we're heading. I guess I'm not clear what waiting is going to help us do, and whether whatever the board decides on leases or revenue actually will help answer that specific question, because this contingent consideration, and I agree with Peggy that we probably need some examples, but in the examples that I've seen, it's a contingency based upon a future event which was not known at the date of acquisition, which is why the IFRS 3 measurement period doesn't quite work. And there are events such as sales or profits or something like that. And so I'm not clear where we're heading on this. I guess that's what I'm asking the staff or Bob for you to help us on this, is where we're going to on this.
My understanding of why we were tracking what was happening in leases and revenue was to understand the reasons as to why the board might end up concluding that you shouldn't recognise a liability on day one of signing a contract in certain circumstances, and to be able to then contrast those reasons with what appears to be the requirement in 32 and 39 that, yes, you should be recognising a liability on day one. And that we could then look at these circumstances and understand, well, is this more similar to the reasons that are given in the leases and revenue project for justifying not recognising a liability on day one, or are we different? Do we not have those particular characteristics, in which case it would look as if we were then into the 32 and 39 recognise a liability?
With the issue of, as Guido pointed out, a conflict between two standards. We're looking at a situation which isn't a lease, therefore isn't in the leases standard. Therefore, we seem to be thrown into 32 and 39, and there's the answer. So I'm not sure that leasing is going to help us, because these things are not leases, unless we want to scope them into the leases standard.
I agree with you. We would need to take some sort of standard-setting action, some sort of development of interpretation or some proposed amendment to a standard in order to then allow or require different accounting. But the reason for being able to propose that, I was envisaging that we would be looking to the justifications and the development of the reasons and the rationale within the leases project or the revenue project as a basis to be able to argue that. But I agree, they're not leases, so we don't automatically get cover from the leases standard.
Put it another way, we're not here to create business opportunities for investment bankers. But if the board reasonably comes to a conclusion that if you lease an asset and attach a contingency to it which affects the amount of the future payments, it isn't beyond the scope of any reasonable person to say, well, instead of buying the asset, I will construct a lease which has got two payments, one up front and one if the contingency occurs. And then you get different accounting. And clearly that's not going to be something that is desirable for anybody. So we have to, I think, wait for the board to take its reasonable decision on what it's going to do in the leasing project. And then being informed by that, I think, as Michael says, we're then faced with the issue that standards conflict. That at the moment, 39 would say there's a liability. You recognize on day one changes in the liabilities go through to profit and loss. Leases, we're assuming, is going to go down a different route, which may be don't recognize any liability up front. Any liability you recognize as a result of the contingency becoming not a contingency is added to the cost of the leased asset, then that's different accounting. So our project, I think, would still be an interpretive project which would require a change to the scope of one or more standards so that it excludes, if you want, it brings down what Andrew was concerned about, it brings down the barrier on 39 and says don't look at 39 for resolving this issue. Or even though it is a financial instrument, just as a lease is, look at the leasing standard for the guidance on the conditions that have to be met, whatever it has to be. And it will be an interpretation, because that's what's required. It's not something that's going to come out of the current leasing project or any other board project. But I don't think we want to end up in a position where there is angst, concern, and divergence in practice that could exist for a period of time until the board can readdress IS 16 and IS 38, if we can, in fact, within a reasonable space of time, carry out an interpretation with the board's agreement on the change to the standards that we require. So we need to ask for their effectively approval to do that. But at the moment, we just don't know what they're going to decide on leases. So where we're going is on this, it needs an interpretation with a change to the existing standards, regardless of what the board decides on the leasing project, but that whatever the board's decision is on the leasing project is something that we can take on board as part of the interpretation project and use the same rationale for concluding whatever the accounting solution is. So we don't know what the answer is, but we know we can get there. Joanna?
I don't want to put the cat among the pigeons with your response that you, or the what you've just said, but I am concerned that if we go back to what we discussed last time and what we said the significant issue is and what we actually asked the staff to do, it was all about the re-measurement of the liability. That's what we said the scope of this project was. I actually think that, and some of the discussion around this the table, and effectively what you've said, Bob, is beyond that. It's about what you recognise up front. And to me, the focus is, and what the initial query was on this, was how do you re-measure the liability?
Joanna, I accept that, but the problem arose, the divergence in practice arose, because the analogy to the previous IFRS 3 was, yep, for this contingency, if you can't reliably measure it, you don't book a liability. But it's something that within the scope of financial instruments would say, but you do book a liability for the fair value of the amount based on whatever information you've got. So we already had a conflict. There are those that say you should recognize a liability up front, those who say not. Old IFRS 3 has gone. There is no longer an analogy that can be made to a standard that doesn't exist. The analogy to the current IFRS 3 says recognize a liability.
And I think we all agreed
but
with that.
The issue that has come up here and why we're talking about this again is that if the leasing project says, if there's a contingency for the acquisition of an asset, a right of use asset in their case, and you do not recognize a liability for that contingency, then people are going to start saying we'd like to analogize to IS 70 or what the IFRS is going to be that replaces it. So it's not an issue that is going to go away. If we're going to come out with an interpretation hot on the heels of the leasing standard that is going to say do or do not recognize a liability, then I think we have to consider it as part of this project.
Okay, I guess what I was saying was I didn't think we were going to come out with anything that said anything to do with whether or not you recognise a liability. It was simply going to be if you've recognised a liability, this is how you remeasure it. I agree that the leases has now thrown into question the first thing, in which case, given that the first question maybe has raised its head, then we should just stop this altogether. Until the leases one is absolutely clear. But there's no point in discussing, but I think we're discussing not the question of what we were asked in the first place. What we were asked was the remeasurement.
So if we go back to question two, then if there is a remeasurement, in what circumstances do you think that that should affect the cost of the asset as opposed to just going to profit and loss or going somewhere else? Laurence.
It's always very difficult to focus on those very specific questions without putting the whole frame. But anyway, I'll come back to question three later on. On the question two specifically, and tying back to what Peggy said, what type of transactions are we trying to address with this project? Basically, it's milestones payments and royalties paid by pharmaceutical companies in purchasing compounds from biotechs and then developing and distributing. Is it perhaps in real estate?
Laurence, don't take it too broad. That we said before, we're focusing on the acquisition of an item of property, plant, and equipment, and we'll broaden the scope later. So don't broaden the scope now and say it's difficult to answer the question.
I thought the scope now was intangible assets and PP&E.
The question is on PP&E. If you acquire an item of PP&E, this is what I want to focus on. If you acquire an item of PPE and there are contingent pricing adjustments that come later, what is the nature of any of those remeasurements occasioned by that contingency that you would think should adjust the cost of the asset? What is it we're looking for in there?
As I said at previous meeting, when some additional payments confirm the nature of the assets, I truly believe they should be part of the cost of the asset. When payments are made,
When you say confirm the nature of the asset, what do you mean?
Clarifying what you have purchased, because on some occasion, you purchase something, you don't know exactly what it is, until you have further evidence of something. And so the payment, so when you purchase something, you say, okay, I'm going to pay you, but once I have a better understanding of what I've purchased, I will pay you this additional amount. In such circumstances, I do believe that this additional payment is truly part of the cost of the asset. In the same way, I do believe that, and again, you don't want to have an analogy with pharmaceutical, but in some cases, also those additional payments are like addition, enhancement of the asset. In which case, I do believe it should go into the assets. On some other occasion...
can I be specific so we don't just ramble too much? If you buy an asset and the manufacturer tells you that this should operate at 100 things, whatever they are, he thinks it will operate at that. And you say, but I'd like it to operate at 120. And he says, well, I can try and tune it to do that. And if I can get it to operate at 120, then you will pay me an extra amount.
Yeah.
That's understanding the nature of the asset, is it?
Understanding the nature of the asset.
All right. But if you use the asset which produces something that you can sell, and the more you sell, the more you're going to pay, then that doesn't change the nature of the asset. Is that a correct depiction?
It depends if by the level of sales you're making, this gives you further insight of the asset you have purchased. I could see it also.
But it doesn't
like
really
that.
Change the
Normally
physical
not,
asset.
Normally not, but I could.
Okay, all right, I understand. We need to move on because we're running out of time. Guido?
I think it makes a lot of sense to wait for the lease project because of two reasons. One is it's interesting that these contingent payments based on sales volume and whatever are added to the asset. And as far as I understand, lease liabilities are part of IS 32, so they are not scoped out. So that's another example where there is another standard that tells you against AG 8, do not expense these costs of a financial liability. So that's one point where I think leasing is interesting. The other one is, again, on the liability side. If the lease project concludes that contingencies based on sales volumes, etc., are not recognized up front, then maybe there is no contradiction to IS 32, because 32 also tells you in paragraph 19, as long as you can avoid making the payment by not selling the product, whether it makes economically sense or not, but that's not part of 32, whether it makes sense or not, you don't recognize a liability. So that might take a little bit of the tension that, well, IS 17 tells you do not recognize it, and 32 tells you do recognize it. I don't think that 32 tells you to recognize the liability up front or maybe later on. So
you're saying specifically that depends on whether the events that will cause the contingent payment are under the control of the buyer or somebody else,
yeah,
or either within the buyer's control or outside the buyer's control.
Well, specifically in the buyer's control, whether the buyer can avoid making the payment by not having the obligating event, which is making the sales, for instance. So
the question two, the other way around then, is that if these events within the buyer's control then come to pass, is that something that should be added to the cost of the asset? That's what we're trying to get at in question two.
Well, I'm in agreement with Laurence, and that's, I think, also reflected in paragraph 23 of the staff's paper, is as long as it's, let me use the word, a non-adjusting event, so you are not changing the asset in any way, but it's about, did I have all the information about the characteristics and so on of the asset at the transaction date, and if I didn't have that, and I have new information about what was the case at the transaction date, then, and I have to make additional payments, then I would add that to the acquisition cost. So I think what is in 23 is a good starting point to think about. So we don't have, and again, I think it's not about intended use or not. So you may use the asset, but get the information later on. So I wouldn't.
I'm trying to fix that compared to what Scott was saying earlier, that the asset is now ready for its intended use.
Yes.
So anything that happens subsequently would not be part of the cost.
I wouldn't say so.
Okay. Scott, sorry, I'm taking words.
No, that's fine. Just going back to what something Joanna mentioned, I think at the last meeting we did all agree that we thought that current literature did lead to recording the liability. The progress of the lease project, I think, causes us to rethink that. But I think Joanna's right. At the last meeting, we all said you got to record a liability. And then this meeting was going to be to talk about changes in that liability. We had the intervening event where the board has now said maybe you shouldn't record the liability in a similar circumstance. My sense is that we ought to come out similar to the lease project, unless the board's explanation of their conclusions on leases relies on something that is unique to leases. If their whole reason for the model they come up with is because in a lease, not making the payment means you lose the right to use the asset, whereas that usually doesn't happen in a purchase because you own it, well, then perhaps we would have a basis for coming out differently. But if the board's conclusion on leasing is don't record the liability up front because it's not reliably measurable, well, I don't know why it would be reliably measurable when purchased either. So it seems to me that we do have to wait. And then we ought to be trying to analogize to the lease project, unless the board's basis for conclusions in the lease project is tied to something that's unique to leases. And if that happens, my sense is we go back to where we were, as Joanna mentioned, that, okay, we all agreed there is a liability to record, and then we got to focus on the changes, which we've been doing doing some talking about and not getting all that far. I have difficulty believing that events that occur during operation of an asset tell you more about its condition when you bought it, but perhaps that's the case. And if so, that could be added to the cost. But my sense is that most of this stuff is equivalent to a profit-sharing payment.
And if it's equivalent to a profit-sharing payment, then you would say it doesn't represent part of the cost of the asset.
That's right.
So if, in fact, somebody had...
Changes in the liability don't represent part of the cost of the asset.
But if somebody had acquired a piece of land and paid $100 for it, but had agreed, purchaser and seller had agreed that if, in fact, something was discovered on there of value, an important mineral deposit, that they would pay an additional amount. And 5 years later, that was discovered. The additional amount was paid, which was $1,000. You would say $1,000 should go to profit and loss.
I think I would have booked an estimate, or excuse me, a fair value of that contingency up front, but changes in that I think I would take to P&L. We could come up with an alternative model that suggests that is something about the condition of the asset we purchased, and then we would book it all on the date that we resolved the contingency. In that case, I probably wouldn't book a liability up front if that was the model we were using.
All right. I don't think we need to ask question three, Fabienne, because we've got the answer to that already, which is that we should wait. But as you're champing at the bit to get something written on this before you depart our shores, which may or may not happen in time, if you do get the opportunity, I get the sense that we should focus more on looking at the board's conclusions on the leasing project and the conditions in which they would adjust the right-of-use asset. And Scott's suggestions, which seem quite reasonable, would be to say, well, is there anything different about the lease or the terms on which the right-of-use asset would have been changed because it is unique to a lease as opposed to unique to any other acquisition, which might cause us not to want to mirror that. But otherwise, the conditions that would trigger a payment that would result in an increase or an adjustment to the right-of-use asset as a consequence of the change in that contingent liability, that we would mirror word for word what's in the leasing standard. And in the meantime, we sit and twiddle our thumbs on this one, that we don't discuss anything again until the board has resolved its position, and then we can bring it back and we'll know exactly what's there. And Laurence, you wanted some illustrations as well. So, I mean, to the extent that the leasing project is dealing with only tangible property, plant, and equipment assets, or at least I think it still is, then it isn't going to give us any pointers for intangibles. So that would be the next phase, once we can agree what we think we would do adjusting for items of PP&E, is then to consider extending the scope to intangible assets within the scope of IS 38. Can't do more than that, can we? Or you want to look at intangible assets immediately?
I just read paragraph 10 of agenda paper 3. Regarding below our findings and our analysis of the drawbacks and advantages of each piece of literature in relation to contingent prices for the purchase of an item of PP&E or an intangible asset. So my understanding from the previous meeting is that we would not limit ourselves to contingent pricing for the purchase of a PP&E, that we were looking broader, and this is what I thought was reflected in the update. Because, I mean, frankly, from my experience...
You're saying the same things. Frankly, you want to get to the same end point. Mark. I'd like to get there sooner, though.
Contingent pricing of the purchases of PP&E, in my experience, is not so much a big issue. I have not made it so many times, perhaps except in the extractive industry.
Andrew?
Just a thought, really. I mean, I agree with what you say there, Bob. I suppose the only thing that might be worth doing in the background in the meantime is looking at, on the assumption that we can get over the IS 39 subsequent remeasurement through P&L issue, on the assumption we can somehow, what sort of debit goes to the cost of the asset and what sort of debit goes to P&L? Because we've already, you know, to me the planning permission one seems like that should go to the cost of the asset. The additional payments, if you make additional profits, that's a bit more tricky. And I don't know, I assume IS 16 and IS 38 can contain enough guidance to tell us what's an asset and what isn't. But, I mean, that seems to me the only other additional work that we could be doing at the moment.
16 really says when it's ready for its intended use, you stop.
Well, maybe it's all in there, but I could see us getting into discussion of, well, okay, we don't have to remeasure it through P&L, but is it an expense or is it an asset?
But I think a lot of that guidance on PP&E is going to come out of the leasing project as to when the right of use asset is going to be changed, which is a consequence of the change in the lease liability. So it's actually addressing the issues that we said we'd look at this time, quite specifically. And then, having learned our lesson from there, to see if we can apply the same lessons to intangible assets. We may have different ones.
I think it may be more appropriate to say wait the conclusion of not only lease but also revenue standards. The reason is the board faced problems how to coordinate the conclusions between the two sides related to contingent payment, but also related to what Lorraine just mentioned. When the board discussed about the contingent payments, as you say, board decided to scope out intangibles, then we cannot discuss contingent payment related to intangibles. Then actually board discussed examples mainly in the intangible side when they discuss the revenue principles around contingent payment. So I think it's much more appropriate to say wait the conclusion of the two projects.
Very sound advice, Wegrove, but I was relying on the sanity of the board actually to conclude on both projects at about the same time with a consistent answer. So I was just choosing the one I thought would come out later. Ruth?
Also, just in terms of background work, as Andrew mentioned, whether we would need to do a scope out of IS 32 and 39 if we followed the leasing approach. I think we'd need to consider that.
I think it's likely that we would conclude that we'd have to scope out at least one of those, and the other one may not really apply. Guido, final comment?
Final and brief. I think it's a good idea to address this issue again, because I think that we do not have to scope it out. So I would ask the staff to look at paragraph 19 and 32, bring it back to us, because 32 says if you can avoid making a payment, and my understanding is that that's also the basis for the board's conclusion that contingencies based on sales could be avoided. So
I understand the point, but sometimes it's easier and it stops people trying to guess whether they're on the knife edge of is it within my control or outside my control, to say regardless of this is how you account for it.
Okay, when that is the conclusion drawn by the board, it's okay, but I fear I understand from what Scott says and so on that maybe people think, well, if it's in 32, you have to recognize the liability up front. I don't think that is necessarily so. So that's something we could do in between whatever the answer is by the board on the leasing project.
I understand what you're saying. 32 won't be with us forever then. Okay. Fabienne, is there anything else you need from the committee to help you on this?
Not for the moment.
Okay. So just we take a break for lunch now, and because we need to build in a bit of extra time to come back to agenda item 2 tomorrow, I suggest we reconvene at 1:45. That's okay?
1:35.
45.